Hello, Ken Wilbur. How are you, sir?
Hello, Mark. Just fine, buddy.
Yeah, it's good to hear your voice. Love you, sir.
Good to hear yours, pal.
Yeah. So we are here in part two of the Unique Self Dialogue. And in part one, if I can just do a 30-second recap, and we'll set up part two, we talked about what we might call the meta theory, if you will. You know, to borrow a term that Peirce liked so much, you know, the meta theory of unique self. You know, what are the broad issues at play? And we talked about things like, you know, true self and unique self, you know, states and stages, separateness and uniqueness. You know, you're not just a letter in the cosmic scroll, but you're the whole scroll, a fractal of it all, the all itself, the integration of Western and Eastern enlightenment, the evolution of enlightenment through the reclaiming of uniqueness post-emptiness, the relationship of the personal and the impersonal, what we called the puzzle piece dharma of enlightenment, you know, unique self and the implications in terms of other, you know, the second face of the divine, unique self and prayer. Those were kind of the core meta topics that we talked about in part one.
Right.
And yeah, and it was a fantastic dialogue, and I know that our buddies, you know, Brett and Joe are actually splitting it up into pieces, so it'll be able to kind of, you know, go out as like, you know, eight or nine different, you know, pieces, which is so exciting, and transcribing it, and that's really, really fantastic and exciting.
Very cool.
And, yeah, very, very cool. And in part two, what we decided last time was that we would talk about the implications of unique self, you know, of this individuation, this higher individuation beyond ego, right? The implications of unique self in the world.
Right.
And, you know, as you and I talked via email, you know, I'll kind of introduce a topic, you know, say a couple of words about it and turn it over to you. And we'll try and run through, you know, a series of topics, you know, including, if I create a little bit of a table of contents and we'll see how far we get, including shadow work, creativity, love, joy, death, you know, sexuality, psychological modalities, business, levels of consciousness, parts and wholes, politics, you know, we'll pick lots of these, evolutionary spirituality, perspectives, you know, et cetera. So kind of the topics that you've written and spoken so much about, you know, from the perspective of unique self.
Okay.
So let's begin with unique self and shadow. And here I'm picking up, Mega K, you know, a conversation that we've had a number of times really since like 2003, when I read Transformations of Consciousness, you know, that book where you wrote that fabulous essay on the different fulcrums and the different pathologies at every fulcrum.
Right.
That was the book with the turquoise cover. That's how I remember your books. What color was the cover? Turquoise cover there, right? And I can find it in the bookshelf. So you know, and in light of that conversation, let me just kind of step in right now directly into content. So you talked about there about how when a person doesn't, and you know, properly transition from one fulcrum of consciousness to another,
right,
when there's a kind of dissociation, so that creates a split off, right, of a dimension of self, which can turn into shadow. And I'm going to turn to you in a couple of minutes just to talk really about that and that structure and how that works.
Yeah.
Right. In response to that, in response to my both, you know, both how helpful that was in my own thinking, right, and how helpful it was in kind of understanding certain dimensions in psychology and levels of consciousness, right, I shared with you a different integral approach to shadow, which, if I would say it in one word, was based not on levels but on types.
Right.
Right. And particularly, you know, if we look at unique self as the ultimate typology, you know, while masculine and feminine are obviously a typology, you know, an enneagram is a way of doing typology, and, you know, the five Buddha families are a way of doing typology, and the Sefirot and Kabbalah, you know, are ways of doing typology, you know, what unique self says is that actually every person is in some sense a typology of one.
Right.
Right, and that therefore, you know, they have infinite dignity, infinite value. They're not reducible, right, to any other typology, and that creates, you know, the great liberal understanding of the infinite dignity and adequacy of the individual.
Yeah.
Now, yeah, which is really, really, you know, critical. So from that perspective, what I started thinking about, you know, 20 years back when my mind still worked, was that you know, as I began seeing in myself, which is always the first place to look, and then I began seeing in people that I was working with, that often their shadow would emerge, right, because they weren't in some sense living their story. And I want to use story here precisely. I don't mean the story that good Vajrayana Buddhism says to move beyond, meaning the story of the coiled and contracted separate self, but I mean story in the sense of the, you know, infinite, unique perspective expression of self that, you know, later ultimately, you know, we started to call unique self. Right? And so in some sense, what shadow, I began to understand that shadow was in some sense unique self distortion, right? That the distortion of unique self, right, created shadow expression. And that began to be, you know, a very, very powerful understanding of how typologies play in such a profound way in shadow. And I was talking to some of our mutual younger friends, you know, Zach, other people, and it really made shadow kind of come alive for them in a way that the classical shadow literature doesn't do, because the classical shadow literature is kind of confused. You're not quite sure what is shadow, and you're not quite sure, you know, why it's important to integrate. There's kind of this clarion call to shadow integration, but no one's quite sure what it is or why. You know, until your essay, which talked about it from one perspective that we're about to get to, but from this typology perspective, you know, something becomes really interesting and really clear. You know, what actually you begin to understand that at its core, right, shadow has the same DNA, right, as your unique self. So you don't have a shadow in a generic sense. You have a unique shadow, which is essentially either the distortion, right, of your unique self, or your unlived unique self, right? Or you know, to borrow a phrase from you that you use, I believe in the No Boundary Consciousness book, I think, right? Where shadow is from a unique self perspective, a lie that you're telling about yourself, right? Although you weren't talking unique self in that book, but you used the term lie, and I remember reading it, and it really struck me, right? You know, it's a lie about yourself. So in this case, if we put these two teachings together, it's a lie about your unique self. It's an unlived story, right? It's an unlived unique self expression. And if I can close by just giving you one example just to make this real and then, you know, talk more about it, you know, after hearing, you know, your perspective, I'll just give you one really, just really interesting example. I was working with a fantastic woman who's the head of a major private school, like the most elite private school in Europe.
Right.
You know, really, really smart, really delightful, really lovely, you know, working with her for several years. And she just had one thing going on, and I asked her permission to tell this story, which is she would get Ken in these kind of arbitrary fights with people, but like really arbitrary. Like all of a sudden, like, you know, this nicest person in the world would kind of draw some line in the sand, you know, and get into this massive argument with the dean of the school. Like, really? Like, it just didn't work. And as we worked together over time, you know, she's a teacher. You know, I asked her to teach me. I said, okay, like, you know, you teach. So next 3 weeks, you know, be my teacher. And of course, you pay me still, but, you know, be my teacher, you know. And, you know, she did 3 weeks of teaching and really great teaching. She taught me the New Testament, Luke 15, I remember. And what was completely fascinating was what she did entirely during the entire time was what I would call feminine teaching. I mean, she held the container. She facilitated me beautifully. But she never took a stand about anything she believed in, right? And as it was kind of classical, the shadow of classical liberal teaching, meaning completely facilitative, but no insemination, no taking a stand.
Right.
And what we realized was that because she was a teacher, that was her unique self. But a key dimension of her teaching persona, meaning the masculine teacher who takes a stand, who inseminates, who draws a line, was actually disowned. So that emerged in shadow form in her taking a stand arbitrarily about essentially irrelevant issues.
Right.
Because she had actually disowned this key part of her unique self, and we gradually worked over a period of time in changing her teaching style to move past that kind of green level consciousness liberal teaching trope and to integrate the masculine. And not only did her evaluation soar, but literally, Ken, we saw in 6 months that shadow dimension she'd worked on for 20 years disappeared.
Wow.
So it's kind of a dramatic understanding of shadow, you know, as unique self distortion and shadow integration, last sentence on my side, then all of a sudden that kind of clarion call, which is so poorly explained in books like Robert Bly's Little Book of the Shadow or in, you know, the classical works, it's just no one understands what it is, right? Now shadow ingration, it's not just to bring your negative attributes into first person and
right.
know that they're there. That's, of
right.
course, a first step, which, for example, you would do in the 3-2-1 process that you developed.
Right.
The next step would be, the natural next integral step would be, you know, to integrate your shadow is actually to integrate your unique shadow, which leads you back to your unique self. You're actually integrating your unlived unique self, and all of a sudden it becomes super clear why it's critical to integrate your shadow, not just because you don't want to be driven by the disowned negativity in you, but more than that, a leapfrog forward, you're actually integrating, right, your personal essence, which actually, you know, is everything that you are and opens up every door. So that's
right.
that's a kind of an exciting, really move, kind of evolutionary leap in shadow understanding. So kind of putting that forth to start the conversation.
Yeah, there are a lot of ways to go at this. Carl Jung used to say that one gets to the self through the shadow.
Yeah.
And which is a type of variation on that topic.
Right.
And I think he had that intuition that you're discussing, that the shadow wasn't, you know, just pathology, but was in some sense part of a compass pointer towards some way that you've gotten derailed in your life. Somehow you've gotten off track, and as you say, it's distorted unique self or unlived unique self or using the no boundary term, it's a lie basically about your unique self. It's a lie about your life. It's where you're not fundamentally telling the truth about yourself, and that leads then, you know, obviously to all sorts of negativities. And you don't have to have repression or reaction formation or any of those things if you're just simply lying,
right?
And, you know, if the shadow is the nexus of the lie. It's the whole core around where you can't face certain truths in a direct and honest and straightforward way. And when these truths in particular have to do with your essence, you're the very core of what you are, then you're telling basically in a sense the biggest lie that you can, and that's going to have the biggest impact on how you fail to live up to your genuine capacities, your true potentials, your real self, your unique self. And it also goes to show that the unique self can't simply overpower what certain conventional things that are going on
right,
in the mind.
Right, that's so important.
Mm. Yeah. So we have to kind of, as usual, where a holistic or integral approach is required, we have to sort of keep one foot in the unique self and one foot in the conventional self and make sure that these two are lined up as well. And so seeing, bringing the unique self into the shadow and having the shadow fundamentally connected with the unique self, I think is a very important move. At the same time, it doesn't stop us from saying, for example, we take the example of the woman that you discussed and how she had gotten caught in a lie about her unique self. But it's more than just a lie. It's a lie at the green level.
Mm. Right.
And so we can still keep the notion of a hierarchy of shadow elements. because that tells us when we started lying about our unique self. When did we get out of touch with our unique perspective? Was it red? Was it amber? Was it orange? Was it green? Is my lie, am I lying to myself about the kind of safety that I want to express with my unique self? Am I lying to myself about the type of belongingness that I want my unique self to be involved in? Am I lying to myself about the self-esteem that I have and how the unique self is connected with that? Am I lying to myself about self-actualization? And am I caught in the green swamp?
Well, that's a brilliant movie. I don't know if everyone gets it. That way I'm going to talk about it. It's a brilliant movie you just made. I mean, you just made a fucking brilliant, pardon the word, brilliant, sorry. Recording. That's a brilliant move. And what you just basically did is you just took the entire levels of consciousness thing and folded it back into, right, the unique self conversation as part of what that lie is.
Exactly.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, and then that gives us a chance of pinpointing with a little more accuracy the type of lie that you're involved with and when it probably happened. If it's red, it's probably something that happened with your parents, and it's probably going to be, therefore, something that you're going to repeat when you get in intimate relationships. And knowing that's going to give you a little bit of a handle on telling the truth about this, and so that you can reconnect with your unique self and what it really wants under that lie. The more you understand that lie and understanding whether it's a red or an amber, or an orange or green, whether it's self-actualization that you're lying about or whether it's even self-transcendence that you're lying about, these important issues that flesh out that lie and point us in the direction where we can bring, again, these two sides of the street together.
Yeah.
And make sure that we're tracking both as carefully as we can.
Yeah. No, that is so super important. I want to actually take a second to unpack for the listener some of the implications of what you said, because we kind of meandered into kind of a super high-level conversation where there's a lot of implications. So let me just share. I would just recommend everyone listening to go back and read Ken's essay, In Transformations of Consciousness. And I'm going to give a very, very, you know, almost superficial but clear enough summation of kind of one core point there, which Ken is building on, you know, in what he's saying right now. Sorry to talk about you in the third person.
Okay.
So basically, let me try and give one example of it. You know, what this essay basically talks about is that at every fulcrum of consciousness, you have to appropriately transcend and include whatever the goods were of that particular level and disidentify with that level in order to move to the next level. But you have to disidentify and not dissociate. Because
right.
If you dissociate, right, then it's a disaster. And,
right.
You know, you've applied that intuition, Ken, in any number of ways, which I think are critically important. You know, for example, in The Marriage of Sense and Souls. You know, that was, I think, your one book with Broadway Books instead of Shambhala, right? which is probably its own story. But you've got the great chapter there on the kind of mistake of modernity where it basically, you know, dissociates instead of disidentifies from certain dimensions of spirit, creating, you know, side by side with the dignity of modernity, the disasters of modernity.
Right.
So you basically apply this intuition, this psychological intuition, structural intuition about dissociation versus disidentification to how culture moves through levels of consciousness or how culture moves through relationships to spirit, and it can apply also to an individual moving through levels of consciousness, right?
Yeah.
To kind of, again, you know, for, I mean, let me just think of one example offhand. I'm thinking of actually my same, you know, good friend in Switzerland, a Swiss woman, right, who, you know, happens to come from, you know, a very wealthy family, which we might call orange,
right,
that kind of orange level, and she moved to green, but instead of disidentifying, right, with orange, she dissociated from orange,
yeah.
And the result was that her two daughters are now mega driven as hedge fund kind of traders completely into finances. In other words, right?
Predictable.
predictable, right? So, and it's exactly your model, right?
Yeah.
Now, instead of disidentifying, she dissociated with orange consciousness. That means that it was disowned in her, which means that it appeared in a raging form in the next generation.
Exactly. Exactly. And then when the kids want to differentiate from their parents, the best thing they can do is identify with something that they have dissociated.
Exactly. No, exactly. And when I shared this with her, right, it was, you know, in working with her daughters, it was a blowaway revelation. And it was kind of really, really powerful. I mean, it was just, wow, it creates an incredible space of insight. And here's where, and I think that's been our excitement over the years, here's where unique self and, you know, it integrates with integral theory in such a natural way, because what we then say is that, you know, your unique self is not only your proclivities, your talents, right, your gift. It's not only, right, your unique perspective, which births your unique gifts, which creates your unique obligation, which we talked about last time, but your unique self is completely refracted through and part and parcel of your level of consciousness.
Right.
And that's utterly, so therefore, part of your unique self is to know, well, where am I on the spiral, to the extent that, of course, you can only know if you're at second tier, because you can only see the spiral then, but you begin to kind of identify and see yourself, you know, and understand where you are in the story. And of course, paradoxically, unique self only appears as a spontaneous level of consciousness. Uniqueness appears as a spontaneous level of consciousness at what you called in one of our conversations a couple of years back, kind of, it's not a deduction, unique self, it's a spontaneous expression, right?
Right.
You know, at second tier, right? At second tier, at the level when you can actually see what your level of consciousness is.
Right.
So key in kind of charting your unique self, you know, position and understanding what the source of your shadow is would be, well, what's my relationship to levels of consciousness? Where am I? What parts of different levels might I have dissociated instead of disidentified from?
Right.
And that becomes part of, right, the lie about my unique self, right? Levels of consciousness are not separate from unique self. They're completely integral to it. So this is a really exciting, this is the first time I think we've put this together this clearly,
yeah,
which is really exciting.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's really good. This is exciting. This is really, really clear. And I think it's going to allow for, you know, the emergence, you know, of, and here's, you know, maybe our next topic. You know, our next topic is what would unique self therapy look like? You know, and we're working, as you know, with you know, the board chair of CWS, you know, Lori Galperin, and her clinical co-director, Mark Schwartz, and, you know, some really leaders in the treatment field, like really the best people, written the most important, you know, essays and books, you know, about developing, and we're now empirically testing it, you know, a kind of unique self therapeutic modality.
Right.
Like, you know, and how would that work? You know, and what would that mean? And, you know, I think that this would be kind of a key piece of the story, right? Right, to be able to, you know, in a person that's relatively healthy, and relatively is always the key word for all of us, right?
Right.
In a person that's relatively healthy, right, to be able to chart, right, you know, where am I in my level of consciousness? To actually see the levels of consciousness and actually bring levels of consciousness directly into the unique self conversation as part of an actual enacted therapeutic modality. And that's exciting, Mega K.
Yeah. No, I agree. There's just any, you know, number of things involved in the therapeutics of the unique self. One of them is certainly coming face to face with the fundamental lie or lies that one has got caught up with in the course of one's life, and facing those and attempting to determine the particular level that they've come from, just because that helps to clarify the structure of the lie, the type of lie, when it possibly happened, the relationships that probably were part of it, and so on. One is identifying your gifts, what talents do you seem to have, and people will most interestingly lie about their talents just as frequently as they'll lie about their negatives, because they just might as well call it the Jonah complex. It's just we're afraid of our greatness,
right?
As much as we are afraid of our negatives and our smallness, and that fear of greatness is simply a fear of your own unique self,
right?
And that's a terrible position to be in. So, being able to identify, you know, one's talents and one's skills and one's genuine gifts depends upon having confronted one's shadow and the fundamental lies that you tell and have told about yourself, because you have to be able to move through the lie in order to be able to stand next to the light, so to speak. Lying about greatness is one of the most sort of unspoken lies that we have, but it's also one of the most common. Just the capacity to actually recognize what the lack of a better word, what the feeling of the divine self is like. What does it actually feel like to be divine? And the Tibetans, for example, one of the most common practices in Tibetan Buddhism is called Yidam practice, and it's a visualization technique where most people have seen these images of a Buddha or two Buddhas in sexual congress, and they're drawn in very colorful figures, and you, in this practice, you identify with the Yidam. You actually visualize yourself as being this particular deity. And there are two marks of successful practice. One is the clarity of the visualization, because what you're doing when you actually hold this visualization is you're doing both concentration and insight awareness simultaneously. One, you're concentrating on the form and holding that in mind without dropping it. And two, you realize that that form is empty because it's still just simply something that you're imagining. So you're realizing that form is emptiness and emptiness is form. So you're which is the definition of insight.
Mm-hmm.
But the second way that you measure success in this practice is by the feelings of divine pride that you hold. And that's the tricky one, because interestingly, what it usually trips up is the ego. And it's odd, because the ego is sort of, almost by definition, the pretender to the throne. It thinks that it's God. It runs around all the time pretending that it's God. But when it's actually faced with being God, it gets embarrassed and fumbles and pulls back and doesn't really know how to say, oh, well, yes, actually, I am that I am. I am the fundamental ground of all being. And to say that without pulling back, to say that without hesitating, to say that without shyness. Trungpa used to say that we don't try to kill the ego. We give it everything at once, and it dies of embarrassment.
And
that's essentially what holding divine pride is. In a paradoxical way, it induces humility.
Right.
And so being able to spot one's lie, being able to spot one's talents, being able to spot one's divinity are among just a small handful of the items that you want to work with when you're working with the unique self. And the unique self plays an important role in all of those. And all of those have been diminished by not being connected with the unique self.
Right.
Because at the very least, it what it's been connected with is just egoic capacities And so it's some conventional self that is being discussed, and divinity, infinity, is being left out of the equation entirely, which, of course, is only the entire ground of all being,
right?
And the ultimate source of all reality is a lousy thing to leave out. Talk about lies.
It's a lousy thing to leave out.
Yes. And which is, incidentally, another fundamental lie is that I don't have a unique self.
Right.
And that really eats deeply, because we're brought up in a culture that denies it.
Right.
And allows only a finite, liberal, egoic self, and denies an infinite, real self. And that's a fundamental lie. That is a deep and fundamental lie that then really affects pretty much everything it touches.
And so
confronting lies is a really fundamental issue in this process, along with one's talents and one's gifts and particular skills and so on, that by definition every individual body mind has.
Yeah, no, that's you covered 7 or 8, you know, key points here, and I want to just you know dance with you in a couple of them, because they're all so critical. It's funny how in confronting lies, you know, people worry about kind of the detailed lies. You know, you didn't tell me that you were making $5,000 more than you are, that you were going out with Jacqueline and with, you know, with Sam. But you know, those lies make people crazy. But you know, we're willing to lie as a society and as individuals. But the essential nature of human dignity. You know,
yeah,
which is just kind of shocking.
It's
about confronting lies, and it's about, you know, the greatest lie, as you framed it, is that I don't have a unique self.
Good.
Right? And paradoxically, that lie is made in the name of individuality.
Yeah.
In our unique self teaching, what we're doing is we're stripping away the straw man that supported that lie.
Right.
In other words, what supported that lie in Western culture is, well, the Enlightenment teaching of the infinity of self was about a kind of no self, was about a kind of true self. Total number of true selves, as you always cite, are one, right? But that means that I'm lost, right? And since this Enlightenment teaching doesn't understand, you know, that I'm actually a higher individuation, I'm actually individuated beyond ego, so we can't accept the Enlightenment teaching, what unique self does is actually strip away, you know, that canard, and actually reveal, right, that actually the great teaching of emptiness and form being one actually holds profoundly the infinite unique dignity, right, of every person as an irreducible expression of essence. And so now there's no more place to hide. We actually get for the first time to claim not only our inalienable right, but our inalienable joy and obligation, which is, you know, that I am a unique self.
Right.
You know, that I'm an infinite expression, you know, unique of essence, unlike, you know, any that ever was. And then what comes online is what you describe emerging out of Tibetan Buddhism as divine pride.
Exactly.
I mean, that's the divine pride. And really the teaching on divine pride then becomes, and you know, it's wild, Mega K, almost every conversation, you know, that's what why I enjoy them so much, you know, is that we're just charting new ground, right? In other words, that divine pride becomes a core unique self practice. The Tibetan Buddhist divine pride practice and the Yidam, you know, YIDM, for those listening,
right,
the Yidam visualization, right, techniques become forms, you know, of actually, you know, accessing a felt experience, right, of my unique self. And although within Tibetan Buddhism, as we've talked about earlier, you know, it's not completely clear whether we're talking true self or unique self. We've tried any number of dialogues to superimpose unique self, you know, on that, you know, eternal drop, you know, that exists in those texts. But, you know, at the same time, we've affirmed unique self as an evolutionary emergent.
Right.
But clearly, you know, we can from an integral mode, in a trans lineage path practice, we can borrow the divine pride and Yidam practices, right, and infuse them with the unique perspective, unique self understanding, and these become then essential spiritual practices.
Yeah, definitely. And again, there's a real paradox about divine pride, and that is that in its wake, it brings this whole atmosphere of humility.
Yeah.
And it which is one of the real, you know, paradoxes of about spirit, and one of the fundamental things that we sort of learn in Metaphysics 101 is that any statement about spirit is going to be paradoxical.
Right.
And not contradictory, but paradoxical. The contradiction is one statement which is true and its opposite is false. In a paradox, we have two opposites, both of which are true.
Right.
And it's been said that a paradox is the truth standing on its head to get attention. and that's what it has here, because what has to happen for you to discover a divine pride is you have to discover the true and unique self, and in order to do that, you have to transcend the egoic self.
Right.
And the egoic self is the pretender to be divine, and that doesn't fundamentally believe it. It simply pretends it. It's part of the lie that the ego is. It's part of its Atman project, where it unable to attain God directly, substitutes itself for God.
Yeah.
And wanders around in that way until it's actually caught up with the desire to, well, show me this. Let me see you. Be God.
Yeah.
Whereupon it tends to wither. And that's what happens with the correct practice of divine pride, is that you start to, in feeling through to this divinity, you really do start to transcend the merely separate self. And that opens the whole door of infinite awareness to the self. And that's been just a completely different world.
And
profound to the core.
Profound, you know, completely different the world and profound to the core. And this idea, right, of, you know, what you've called the Atman Project, and, you know, I called it pseudo-eros. You know, it's the same basic understanding, you know, where you're not in eros, you're in pseudo-eros, right? You're not actually in Atman as Brahman, you're in this Atman project in which the ego is pretending to the throne, or as the Sufis say, the servant is pretending to be a king, right? Okay. But here's the interesting thing, Mega K. In other words, if there wasn't unique self, if unique self wasn't the nature of reality, the ego would have no chance of pretending. And I think it's an important, simple, but powerful point. In other words, if the nature of reality was true self, if emptiness wasn't form, meaning, if it wasn't true that every true self has a unique perspective, which means that uniqueness is an ineradicable and irreducible part of reality, and that's actually, you know, what Nagarjuna intuited and what we've unpacked through unique self in its evolutionary emergent form, you know, bringing, you know, a whole bunch of postmodern insights on perspective, you know, into the mix. But if it wasn't true that unique self is the nature of reality, the ego would have no chance. And it's the reason the ego has a chance is because the ego is hijacking the actual reality of unique self.
Yeah.
Right? It's pretending to be unique self. If ego was pretending to be true self, right, everyone would recognize it immediately. Ah, that's not true self. That's the ego. Right? But the ego is pretending to be unique self. And the ego's very existence and the power of its pretending points to there being a higher order clarified version of ego, which is post-emptiness, which is unique self.
Right.
And so I think that's just a really critical, you know, kind of understanding.